United States versus Hopkins.
May it please the court. Morning, Your Honors. My name is Jason Bowles. I'm from Albuquerque, New Mexico, and I represent Mark Hopkins, defendant appellant and petitioner in this action. Your Honors, in March of 2013, Judge Briscoe authored an order and judgment in the underlying direct appeal, and that opinion sets forth in great detail the factual background. But I wanted to give a thumbnail sketch of just the procedural background. In essence, in April of 2009, Dr. Hopkins and his wife, Sharon, were indicted in New Mexico for 7 counts of tax evasion and 1 count of conspiracy to evade taxes. In the ordinary order setting conditions of release, the court ordered no further crimes be committed by the defendants. Approximately October of 2009, the government raised an issue with regard to the defendant not paying quarterly tax payments into the IRS and contended that was a crime. Court held a hearing. The court said that those quarterly tax payments would be paid as a condition of release and they would go into the court registry. Fast forward, approximately $130,000 was paid into the court registry. Dr. Hopkins and his wife then started experiencing issues, including medical issues for Ms. Hopkins, and then mounting legal bills. There was an attorney named Jonathan Altman who represented Sharon Hopkins. Then there was an attorney named B. Kraft who represented Mark Hopkins. And then an attorney named Miles Hennessy who was local counsel for all defendants. At the time that the bills were mounting and the $130,000 was in the court registry, counsel filed the motion for the court to modify conditions and to release those funds to be able to pay medical bills, legal expenses, and some other things they had going on. June 2010, District Judge Armijo, did sua sponte reconsider the order to make payments going to the registry. And basically what Judge Armijo said is, I'm not going to get in the middle of the IRS and the litigants, and I'm going to leave that up to those parties. That was about June 18th. About June 21st, counsel for the defendants went to the court to get the money, and they declined to release it because the IRS had issued a lien. At that point, the funds get interpled into a separate action, which Judge Chip Johnson presides over. The government then files a motion for summary judgment, and the funds are never released. That's in 2010 at this point. Trial happens September 22nd, and the defendants are convicted September 29th of 2010. Counsel, Mr. Altman, withdrew approximately 2 months before the trial happened. And he withdrew because of non-payment of funds. His bill was about $80,000 by that point. Counsel then, Sharon Hopkins, retained Tommy Cryer. And the trial then happens with Mr. Beecraft, Mr. Cryer, and Mr. Hennessy. Now, the government is correct that Mr. Hennessy and Mr. Beecraft were in from the beginning and did stay in, even after the funds were not released. Mr. Altman is the attorney who withdrew, and Ms. Hopkins had to get a new attorney. So the argument, and I think what's preserved in the district court, is that this was a joint defense amongst husband and wife, that they shared resources and counsel, in essence, and that the other argument is that Mr. Altman was given a number of original documents. These original documents were critical to their defense, and when he withdrew, he wouldn't give the documents back because he hadn't been paid. And that's the essence of it. So their argument to the district court was, we've been denied our right to counsel, our choice of counsel, under Powell, under those cases, because we have lost the primary counsel, Mr. Altman.
Well, the we isn't really right. Is that correct? Wasn't it only Mrs. Hopkins that asserted the right to counsel and that the failure to have access to these funds deprived her of counsel?
That was correct in the court of in the appeal, and Your Honor, Judge Briscoe, you authored that opinion and noted that only Ms. Hopkins appealed that issue, and that is correct. Now, in the district court, They both raised it, and in the record at 238, 199 actually in 238 through 242, there are declarations of Mark Hopkins. There's also a declaration of Sharon Hopkins, and they're filed under oath. And basically, they espouse this joint defense. But you're absolutely correct, Your Honor. He did not raise this on appeal. I also want to just cut to the chase on the legal argument. I believe the strongest legal argument Mr. Hopkins has is that this is a new rule. Luis is a new rule, and that it is a watershed rule of criminal procedure.
I thought your argument in both your opening and your reply brief was that it was a new right, but an old rule.
And you're right, and I reflected on that, and I want to, I'm not going to say I'm going to abandon it, but I don't think it's a good argument. I don't think it's my primary argument.
So you agree that it wasn't a misstatement just now. You're saying it was a new rule.
Yes, sir. Yes, Your Honor. I think it's a new rule. I think the idea that in Luis itself you had three dissenters, pretty vigorous dissenters, Kennedy, Alito, and Kagan. You had a split. You also had even this court's opinion 2013 analyzed Kaplan and Drysdale and Monsanto, and the argument could be made that, and the argument has been made, that the prior opinions in Kaplan and Monsanto dictated this result.
Hey, are you able to make that argument for the first time in oral argument? I mean, if your opening and your reply brief both very strenuously argued that it was an old rule, and so Teague doesn't apply. Ms. Messick had argued in her red brief that, well, if it was an old rule, then it was an old right, because our precedents equate whether something is a new rule and a new with whether or not it is a new right under 2255F. So it comes as a surprise to us, and I'm sure your adversary. So have you bypassed this argument?
Your Honor, we made that argument in our opening brief on the Teague.
That it was a new rule?
Yes, sir. That was one of our alternative arguments, that it was a new rule of criminal procedure.
Well, I don't mean to interrupt. I'm sorry to interrupt you, but as I understood, your alternative argument was that it was an old rule, but if we're wrong about that, then it falls within the substantive exception to Teague. And or it is a watershed rule of criminal procedure under the second exception of Teague.
Yes, sir.
Okay.
That is absolutely what we argued. And I'm saying I believe it is a watershed rule of criminal procedure, and it's part and parcel of Gideon and those decisions on the right to counsel. Luis was basically a new application of the right to counsel rules, in essence. So, whereas before, it was any forfeiture of tainted funds could be done. The Luis court separated out untainted funds from tainted funds. And I think another point in this record that's undisputed, I don't think there's any argument that these were tainted funds in the sense of a drug operation or something to that effect. And Judge Briscoe analyzed this in the 2013 opinion. There was an IRS lien as opposed to a forfeiture.
Yeah, you
statute.
Can't get more tainted, right, than an IRS lien, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, Your Honor. There was an IRS lien, and that, unlike the forfeiture statute, which has a relation back, right, where the moment the act of drug crime is committed, that the property passes title, the lien is different with the IRS. So I think the record is clear. These were untainted funds that were seized and locked up. And the other point in the record, the IRS filed a number of liens for taxes dating back to the 90s. So it's apparent that many bank accounts, many assets of the defendants were liened. And I think that was the reason for the request for the $130,000 back. And at that time, there was a pending $80,000 bill that they could not pay to Mr. Altman. And so their argument is that essentially destroyed the relationship with Mr. Alton, who was their counsel of choice, and he wouldn't come back even if they could have gotten the money a little later.
What issue did you raise before the district court as regards new rule, not new rule, Is that the issue you raised before the district court, the same you're raising here?
I believe that that Mr. Hopkins himself, in his habeas petition, did raise that Luis established a new rule. Judge Armijo did say that this was a old rule, I believe is what Judge Armijo held, that it was not subject to retroactive application under Teague, and that was her opinion.
And what did you argue?
I've just been in on an appeal, Your
just
Honor.
Just only, okay.
Mr. Hopkins.
And you, is your view that your argument parallels that of the petitioner that was raised before the district court?
I do believe it does in his habeas petition and what he has said.
In your, did you have another question?
Go ahead.
Okay. In your brief to us, your opening brief, you said Luis applied a well-established constitutional principle to govern a case which is closely analogous to those which have been previously considered in the prior case law. Based on your own argument to us in your opening brief, shouldn't we say that this is not predicated on a new right? I mean, you told us it was something that had existed for a long time.
I did say that, and I said in the alternative, under Teague, it was a watershed rule of criminal procedure. In preparing for this, it seemed to me the right of counsel is an old right, and that's obviously rooted in the Sixth Amendment. The idea that untainted funds could not be seized by the government to prevent somebody from hiring counsel of their choice was a new rule, was a new application of case law. And I don't think every reasonable jurist saw that coming, because even the Supreme Court, the dissenters, were vigorous in that.
Well, if what you said is right, it doesn't matter if it falls within one of the Teague exceptions, because it wasn't predicated on a new right. Recognized by the Supreme Court, which is language from 2255 F3.
It's a confusing area, and I think it's kind of, I'm trying to be intellectually honest about it. There's always been a Sixth Amendment right to choice of counsel. So there wasn't anything new about the Luis opinion on that. The only thing that was new was you can't seize untainted funds. So I'm not exactly sure how to characterize that. It's a new application on an old rule is essentially what it is.
Did I ask you a couple of questions about Luis, but also tie it back in to the statute that I think we're working with right now, which is 2255 F3. And we're talking about the timeliness issue. It really traces back to that. And the statute talks about the date on which the right asserted was initially recognized by the Supreme Court, if that right has been newly recognized by the Supreme Court and made retroactively applicable to cases on a collateral review. So that's that. I think everything sort of starts there and comes back there. And my question to you is, was the right asserted in Dr. Hopkins' 2255 motion the right that was recognized in Luis?
I believe it is. That was recognized March 30th of 2016, the right to not have untainted funds seized that you were going to use to pay for choice of counsel.
I guess the reason I'm asking you is I understand that that's generally, but these cases aren't on all fours. I mean, you didn't have the IRS lien in Luis, and so do we truly have the same right being asserted?
Well, I think you had in Luis you had a substitute asset provision of the healthcare fraud statutes, and I think they were litigating under that provision. So it's analogous to an IRS lien where the government hasn't transferred title yet, but they have a right of some sort under a statute or lien provision ultimately to get that money if there's a conviction. So I think it's completely analogous in that sense to Luis, that they were proceeding under a substitute asset provision of that healthcare fraud statute.
All right. Let me move on to another related question. Statute talks about right newly recognized made retroactively applicable to cases on collateral review. I take it you would agree that the Supreme Court in Luis didn't say anything about retroactivity.
I do agree with that.
And I take it that you have to rely on a Teague exception to survive on this appeal.
I do.
And so your case, if I'm understanding your argument, rises or falls on the watershed procedural rule.
It rises or falls on that. I absolutely believe that.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Paige Messick. I'm an assistant United States attorney in the District of New Mexico. I'm trying to assess where we are now after all of the concessions on argument here, and I think that the last point put it exactly correctly. Unless this is a watershed rule of criminal procedure, the district court was correct in dismissing the 2255 as untimely. And the short answer to that question is that no, it is not a watershed rule of criminal procedure. To be a watershed rule, two requirements are present. First, the rule must be necessary to prevent an impermissibly large risk of inaccurate conviction. The mere chance of a more accurate result applying the new rule does not meet this standard. That's not enough to upset finality, as the court explained in Teague. Now, it's clear here that there is not an intolerably high risk of an inaccurate conviction because the right to counsel of choice has important limits that would be inconsistent with that understanding. Chief among them, indigent defendants are not entitled to have the government pay for counsel of their choice. Defendants are also not entitled to counsel of their choice if that attorney is not licensed in the appropriate jurisdiction, if there is a conflict of interest. There are a lot of qualifications to this right that wouldn't exist if the right to counsel of choice were so absolute that it was necessary to an accurate result. So choice of counsel can't be thought to be crucial to the accurate result in the way that the first requirement needs. The second requirement is that the watershed rule has to alter our understanding of the essential bedrock procedural elements. Being based on a bedrock procedural element is not enough. Clarifying the scope of a bedrock procedural element is not enough. As I believe counsel conceded in argument, the Sixth Amendment right to counsel and the related right to counsel of choice were both well established before Luis, and that undercuts his argument that Luis was a watershed rule of criminal procedure. You could say that Luis maybe broke new ground, but it was certainly not earth-shattering, and it does not, therefore, meet the requirements to be a watershed rule of criminal procedure. There are a number of other things that I might take issue with, the statement of facts, whether he has preserved any argument in the district court, if this were a timely motion, given his failure to raise this issue on in his own appeal. I would contest whether these funds were tainted. I believe that they were tainted, and so Luis wouldn't apply. And Luis also may not apply because
this argument would be that there was a waiver if it were regarded as timely. You're not saying that he waived his argument in objecting to the summary dismissal based on timeliness by virtue of whatever he raised or didn't raise on appeal.
What I meant to say with that is that it's not a timeliness issue, so we're not considering that right now. But if we were back, if the court said, no, it actually was timely, then we would have a number of other things to say, is all I'm saying.
Okay.
For instance, that he didn't raise this argument in his own direct appeal. So we have a lot of things that
And so what? Can he raise it now if it's a new right and it's all different and he should have another shot?
Well, I don't believe that he can't show that he couldn't have raised it below. He can't show cause for this procedural default because his wife did raise this essential issue. If he had joined in her appeal here, he might have an argument here that he should be able to raise the new aspects of Luis, but he abandoned that argument as to himself when he failed to raise it below. I'm not suggesting the court should decide this case on any of those grounds. I'm merely saying that I take issue with a number of those things. I don't think that they're at issue, however, on appeal. It sounds like, based on where we are now, the only question is whether this was a watershed rule of criminal procedure, and the case law is clear that it is not. If the court doesn't have any further questions, then I will wrap up.
Do you think the issue that is now being voiced at oral argument is the same issue that was raised and addressed by the district court?
I think it's close enough, given that Mr. Hopkins was pro se below. His habeas petition alleged that Luis was a new right that opened a new window. Now, some of the positions his counsel has taken on appeal I don't think are consistent with that initial assertion, but I think that Mr. Hopkins raised it well enough for a pro se plaintiff or for a pro se defendant in the district court to preserve that here. District court correctly dismissed this petition as untimely, and this court should affirm. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you both for your arguments this morning. The case is submitted. Court is in recess until 9 o'clock tomorrow morning.